This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Our guest, Jamie Tehrani, says that fairy tales have evolved and adapted over time just like species do. He took many versions of the story of Little Red Riding Hood and followed the thread of the narrative back more than 2,000 years and found different versions in different parts of the world. He wrote about his findings in a recent edition of the journal PLOS ONE in a report titled The Phylogeny of Little Red Riding Hood. Well, we were intrigued, and we asked him to join us from Britain, where he's an anthropologist at Durham University, joining us from the studios of Durham University. And Jamie Tehrani, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So what version of Little Red Riding Hood did you grow up with?
Oh, I suppose I grew up with the one that most British people would be familiar with, which is the Grimm Brothers tale, where Little Red Riding Hood goes to visit her sick grandmother, and then on the way there, she encounters this wolf. And despite having been warned by her mother not to stray from the path, not to speak to strangers, she engages the wolf in this conversation, ends up at her, tells the wolf where she's going. The wolf gets to the grandmother's house before she does, eats the poor old lady and climbs into her bed wearing her nightgown. And when Little Red Riding Hood arrives at her grandmother's house, she's tricked into believing that that wolf is actually her grandmother, and she gets into the bed, and it's there that there's the famous dialogue where she looks at the wolf and says, "Oh my grandmother, your eyes are looking so big. Why is your mouth so big?" Just as she realizes that actually what she thought was her grandmother is this dangerous predator, she's eaten alive. But fortunately, she's rescued by a passing woodcutter who sees the wolf asleep in the bed, snoring away with his tummy full of Little Red Riding Hood and grandmother, and cuts open the wolf's stomach and takes out the Little Red Riding Hood and grandmother, who fortunately haven't been digested yet at that point, and so emerge safe and well, and their bodies are replaced by stones. And when the wolf wakes up, he goes to get a drink from the well and falls into the well because of the weight of the stones and dies. But I mean, that's certainly not the original version.
No.
But it's probably the version that maybe most of your listeners will also recognize.
Well, I'm sitting here nodding because I think that's largely the version that many Americans remember from Little Red Riding Hood. Interestingly, though, I was reading a bit about you. Your dad is Iranian and your mom is British. So
right.
I wonder if there is an Iranian version of Little Red Riding Hood?
Yes, there is. I wasn't actually familiar with that. I didn't grow up with that version. I suppose, like most people, I learned my fairy tales from my mum. So my mum being British, I learned the British version. And there are lots of different versions in every country, of course, but there is a famous version from Iran in which Little Red Riding Hood is actually a boy rather than a girl. And this boy is off to visit his father, who's a farm labourer, and takes lunch for his father, and then encounters the wolf. And the rest of the story is quite similar, but the identity of the relative is different, you know, i.e. it's a father instead of grandmother, and it's a boy instead of a girl. And I think that exemplifies really this process of adaptation in stories that I'm particularly interested in, because in lots of countries around the world, including in Iran, or certainly in parts of Iran, it would be quite unusual for a girl to be wandering around the fields by herself, wandering through the woods by herself. So it makes sense to change that detail of the story to make the girl a boy. And then that suddenly becomes a story that's going to make a lot more sense, that's going to get passed on more than a story where listeners might think, "Oh, that's a bit strange." People generally adapt stories to fit with you know, local cultural norms and customs and expectations.
I have to say that I looked up the word phylogeny before interviewing you. I wanted to make sure that I understood having to do with evolution, the history of a species. And what you're really saying is that fairy tales, and in particular this fairy tale, has behaved like a species in that it has adapted, evolved, and changed over time.
That's right. I mean, the thing about fairy tales, and indeed all traditional stories, myths, legends, is that they don't, they weren't written by a single author. They don't have a creator, if you like. Right. They've been crafted by generations. They get told and slightly adapted, altered, and then passed down to the next generation. The same thing happens as these tales spread from society to society, as that example of the Iranian version that I just explained is a nice demonstration of. You know, that people change the story to fit with audience expectations. And over time and over space, you get this modification of the tale. It is descent with modification in that literal evolutionary sense.
Well, I'm curious about, I mean, were you able to, in a sense, create a kind of family tree that shows us the evolution of this story of Little Red Riding Hood?
Exactly. So phylogenetics, phylogenies, are family trees.
Right.
The science of phylogenetics is the science of reconstructing evolutionary relationships of biological organisms. And what I've argued in this paper is that you can actually take those methods and apply them to another domain where we see descent with modification, which is traditional storytelling, where you have this cumulative change through time, much like the change that we see in biological species over time.
So how many stories were you working with? And it seems like your conclusion says that the roots of this story that has evolved over time goes back more than 2,000 years. But how many stories were you working with?
I looked at 58 versions of Little Red Riding Hood from Western Europe, including those really familiar versions like the Grimm brothers version of the story, but variants from the Middle East and from Africa and from East Asia, which they're a particularly interesting set of stories from East Asia, which have long been regarded as possible ancestors of the European story. But my analysis actually didn't support that view.
Yeah, what is your analysis? What is your conclusion here?
So the reason why the East Asian tales have been long regarded as possible ancestors of Little Red Riding Hood is because there's a very similar story to Little Red Riding Hood known as The Wolf and the Seven Little Kids, or sometimes just known as The Wolf and the Kids, which is another classic Western fairy tale. You find it in the Brothers Grimm collection. And in this story, you have a nanny goat who leaves her little goat kids at home and warns them not to open the door. So you have that sort of similar warning as the one that Little Red Riding Hood got from her mother. The nanny goat warns them not to open the door unless they hear a certain password. But a wolf who's standing outside the door, lurking nearby, hears this password and then imitates the voice of the mother after she's gone out and tricks the little goat kids into letting him into the house by pretending to be their mother and eats them up and is later rescued by the mother, who cuts them out of the wolf's stomach, you know, using her horns. Now, there are clear similarities between this story and Little Red Riding Hood, and that has left a lot of folklorists wondering whether they're directly related to one another, that perhaps they share a common ancestor. And interestingly, you have this group of stories from East Asia which have characteristics of both Little Red Riding Hood and The Wolf and the Kid. So they seem to be this missing link that folklorists have speculated about. Now, in my analysis, what I found was that, in fact, the similarities between the East Asian stories and Little Red Riding Hood and The Wolf and the Kids are likely to be features of those stories which evolved relatively recently. In other words, they probably weren't present in the last common ancestor of The Wolf and the Kids and Little Red Riding Hood, but are more recent additions to the story. And so because of that, it's much more likely that the reason why the East Asian stories are similar to Little Red Riding Hood and The Wolf and the Kids isn't because they're a missing link, but because they're a hybrid of those two Western fairy tales. So that as these tales spread east to China and Japan and Korea, they were put together to create a new story, and they were blended, of course, with local folktale elements as well. So really turning that idea of the East Asian origin on its head using these biological methods.
But it is so interesting. I mean, one can hear the parallels in these stories, The Wolf and the Kids. First of all, you have a wolf. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, even as you look at some of these 58 stories, a wolf is a predatory animal in many ways. Is a wolf a central animal feature of the story of Little Red Riding Hood and all its various incarnations?
No, I mean, in fact, you find in many versions the predator will be a completely different animal. You get versions where it's a hyena, a crocodile in one version, a monstrous ogre. In many of the East Asian stories that I was just referring to, instead of a wolf, it's a tiger or a leopard. So in fact, the actual predator is very variable. And again, that's quite a good example of how people adapt these stories to suit local circumstances. So, you know, in places where, you know, maybe wolves aren't the dangerous animal that people warn their kids about, you know, maybe it'll be a tiger or a leopard or something, then it makes sense to replace the character of the wolf with a more locally relevant predator.
And about a minute before our first break here, but what you're talking about is an oral story, obviously, and one that traveled the world because of migration patterns, yes?
Yes, I mean, I think there are still some very important questions that remain about how exactly these stories spread so widely around the world. But my guess would be that migration was a major factor. You know, we know that these stories are passed down from mothers to their children. I expect that as people spread around the world and as groups intermarried with one another, we know that no population is isolated. Every population is very mixed genetically, racially, you know, in every way, that people not only brought their genes with them, but also their stories too.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. And yes, indeed, we are talking about Little Red Riding Hood in this hour of Radio Times and other fairy tales. Jamie Tehrani is an anthropologist at Durham University. And we saw a paper that he wrote published in the November 13th edition of the journal Plus One, and the paper titled The Phylogeny of Little Red Riding Hood. And we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. From the creative team that brought you This Is the Week That Is and our show of shows, 1812 Productions celebrates the holidays with its newest original production, The Big Time, New Vaudeville for the Holidays, featuring Jennifer Childs, Scott Greer, and Dave Jadico. The Big Time reunites Philadelphia's comedy dream team and brings the steamer trunk circuit into the 21st century. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
Getting ready to put your lawnmower to bed for the winter? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll take a look at whether you should make the last cut a low one to prevent snow mold, plus invasive plants and sustainable landscapes, and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Durham University anthropologist Jamie Tehrani. And in a recent study, he traced the Little Red Riding Hood story back about 2,000 years to discover this tale's origins and its evolutionary path. That's what we're talking about today on Radio Times, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm curious, just, you know, when you go back 2,000 years and find this, I guess, location of the start of the story, where are we when this story starts? What part of the world do you see the roots of this particular story?
Well, it's very likely that Little Red Riding Hood, in the form that we know it, evolved in France or possibly in northern Italy in late medieval times. Mm. There's an 11th century story which seems to be a kind of predecessor of Little Red Riding Hood, which we don't have, unfortunately, a full text for, but it's referred to in a poem that was written in Latin by a priest in Belgium, and he talks about how the local peasants have a story about a little girl who goes wandering around, out by herself in the woods, and she encounters a wolf, and the wolf attacks her, but she is saved by because she's got divine protection that's given to her by this red baptism tunic that she's wearing that was a gift from her godfather. And this might explain the origins of the red hood that we're familiar with. Why does she wear a red hood? It's something that, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about. It could just be a historical artifact which would have been meaningful in this 11th century version. Now, the tale seems to have evolved a lot since then, but I think that the root of the story can be traced back to the ancestor of the wolf and the kids, that tale about the nanny goat that I told earlier on. Now, this story has certainly been around since the first century AD in Europe. It was recorded by a fabulist called Phaedrus, who was born a Thracian slave. He was born in Macedonia, but he spent most of his life living in Roman Italy. And he became famous as a teller of Aesop's fables. So it's possible that this story of the wolf and the kids, or the very early version of it, in which, incidentally, the goat kid doesn't let the wolf into the house, but actually realizes that the wolf is trying to trick him. Now, it's possible that this is an original Aesop's tale, but there's no physical evidence of that.
Sure.
The thing about Aesop is that he was a great brand for medieval storytellers. So if you had a great fable and you attributed it to Aesop, then that would really help it catch on. And so we need to be a little bit cautious about attributing these stories to the actual figure of Aesop himself. But certainly Phaedrus wrote his version of this story in the first century. So that's where the 2000 years came.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure I wasn't totally off on that.
But
I am interested in going back to this idea of fairy tales acting like species and adapting.
Yeah.
The fact that this is a story that we still tell our children today. There might be various versions of it, but it's a story that seems to be to tell us some important things about survival, I guess, about deception, about grandmothers and little girls and wolves.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that I mean, we were talking earlier, Marty, about the predator, the character of the predator, right. And how it's might be a different animal in different locations. Now, we can take that literally as, you know, maybe it's teaching kids about, you know, dangerous animals and things. But I think that that's, we shouldn't be quite that literal. I think there's a deeper meaning to this story. The predator is a metaphor. It's not about the dangers presented by animals, but the dangers presented by people who aren't what they seem to be. And that's what Little Red Riding Hood right. is really all about. So the idea that you need to be careful who you trust. You know, don't just trust appearances. And that's what makes this, I think, such a compelling story, a story that really has an important lesson in it, and one that you're going to remember. I mean,
sure.
I don't think anybody can forget the story of Little Red Riding Hood. It's just such a great tale.
Indeed it is. But it's also, I guess, about adaptation. I mean, the fact that this story, which tells us to be careful of people, has to do with survival, the way that species have to, I mean, they adapt in order to survive.
Yes, that's right. Of course, you know, you get some elements of the... I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the story, and one of the reasons why it's been so successful, is because you can adapt it to make it more relevant. You can change who the protagonist is, whether it's a boy or a girl. You can change the species of the predator. You can change the setting. You know, you can change who the relative is. But the core message is eternal, if you like. It's always relevant. And I think that the most successful stories are precisely the stories that are highly adaptable, where, you know, the underlying message can be communicated in lots of different ways. And we see even now lots of versions of Little Red Riding Hood in popular culture.
Yes.
You know, from the great you know, recent movie Hard Candy, if any of your listeners have come across that, that's a, you know, fantastic modern telling, a kind of Hitchcockian fairy tale version of it, through to the Hollywood movie Red Riding Hood from a year or so ago, which are really quite different from, say, the Grimm Brothers version or the Charles Perrault version, which was the first written version of the fairy tale back in 1697. You know, and yet we can still recognize sure. it's still clearly the same story, and that's the power of this plot.
And the final question to you, are you going to write a paper, The Phylogeny of Hansel and Gretel or Sleeping
yes.
Beauty? Or I mean, you could keep going on this, could you not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Little Red Riding Hood is a fascinating case study, but there are many other similar stories that have spread all around the world that you know, we know have been around for generations, for centuries. The story of Cinderella is a great example. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of versions of that around the world. So absolutely, you know, I'm hoping to carry on this work, and it's a lot of fun, and I've got, you know, two small children of my own, so it certainly gives me plenty of material at bedtime.
Well, we appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And that's Jamie Tehrani, and he's an anthropologist at Durham University. And again, his paper, The Phylogeny of Little Red Riding Hood, published in the November 13th edition of the journal PLOS ONE. We were interested in some of his research, and it's the start of a conversation today. We do want to talk about fairy tales, the evolution of fairy tales, why we love them, why they are so scary, and what is it about fairy tales that children find so intriguing and so engrossing. There is nothing G-rated about the stories, which often include murder and mutilation and wicked stepmothers and trickery and sexual undertones and sometimes sexual overtones. And joining us now is Maria Tatar, the John L. Loeb Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature. She chairs the program in Folklore and Mythology at Harvard University. Maria Tatar, you've been listening in on our conversation, and thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great to be with you.
So why do you think Little Red Riding Hood has endured all these many, many years?
Well, it's everything that Jamie described. It's a simple story. We all remember it. And it's about a girl, a wolf, and an encounter in the woods, some sort of scary meeting. And I think that I'll just present the counter argument,
sure,
which is that I see it as a tale that sort of goes back to the beginnings of civilization, to the campfires, campsites, where we started telling stories as a survival mechanism. What do you do when you meet a wolf in the woods? What about that predator who's going to pounce on you? How do you outwit him? How do you outfox him?
Well, and the predator who is disguising himself, in this case, as a grandmother and gets a little girl in bed with him. What do you make of that part of the story?
Right. And I think that, the story really began as something about, monsters, beasts, predators out in the woods. And then there's this interesting inflection point with Charles Perrault, I think, in 1697, where we get a moral to the story that tells us, that there are these real wolves with hairy pelts and enormous teeth. But then Perrault tells us there are also wolves who are smooth-tongued and smooth-pelted, and they are the most dangerous wolves of all. And suddenly we realize that animals, as Levi-Strauss tells us, are good to think with.
Sure.
Animals are good to think with because they tell us about human beings. They tell us about those seductive predators, the monsters who live right next door. And, if you look back at some of the early versions of Little Red Riding Hood, that is pre-Perrault. Perrault was the first to write it down, but we have folklorists who were looking at the oral tradition in the 19th century. Folklorists, notoriously culturally conservative, so some of the versions that they recorded go way back. And in those stories, we don't have what big teeth you have or what big eyes you have, but we have a wolf who tells the girl to take off her apron. You won't be needing it anymore. Take off your bodice. Throw it in the fire. You won't be needing it anymore. So this is a girl who performs a little striptease in front of the wolf and then gets into bed with him. She then realizes that he's not a wolf, or rather, this is not Granny, but a wolf. And what does she do? She tells the wolf that she has to go outdoors to relieve herself. And so she is a kind of trickster figure who escapes, who doesn't need a huntsman, as in the Grimm's version, but manages to get back home on her own. So, to me, it's just so fascinating that you get all of these different versions swirling around in the cauldron of story, some literary, some oral. And now, as Jamie pointed out, we have Little Red Riding Hood on screen at the movies. And what has she become? She's become a revenge seeker. She is now the killer, as in Hannah or Hard Candy or, Freeway, this horrifying Reese Witherspoon movie in which Little Red Riding Hood is a juvenile delinquent being pursued by a serial killer, a pedophile serial killer named Bob Wolverton. So she gets that. We've turned Little Red Riding Hood into something of a warrior woman.
Well, I will never think of Little Red Riding Hood the same when I think of her and the striptease. And again, we are talking about the, the evolution of fairy tales. We've been focusing a lot on Little Red Riding Hood. We do want to talk about some other stories as well. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. To be honest with you, I didn't give much thought to fairy tales until my son was little. That was many, many years ago. And I would read him all the fairy tales that parents read their children. And frankly, I was so shocked at how violent and gory the stories are. Of course, he loved them, as children do. And it's so interesting is that, we don't allow our children to go to movies that would have mutilation, but we don't seem to have a problem reading stories to them, or at least I didn't.
Oh, well, I think especially if you are there, you've created a contact zone with your child, and the story is much less scary. Mm. You can also turn the violence into something humorous. When the wolf gobbles up the little girl, as he does in the Grimm's version or in Perrault's version. And in Perrault's version, the girl never makes it back out again. But you can start, you know, you can. We all say, oh, you're good enough to eat.
Yes, we
do.
That's
pretty scary. That's much scarier than the story of Little Red Riding Hood. And you can sort of act that out and create a new ending and have Little Red Riding Hood eat the wolf, or, you know. So there's a playfulness and improvisational quality to the storytelling, which I think makes it easier to take. But I love the fact that, you know, all three of us, Jamie, you, and I, had to wait until we had children to really engage with these stories. I mean, we may have read them as kids, but the fact of the matter is these stories began as multi-generational tales. They were told around the fireside, at campsite. They were the, John Updike tells us, they were the television and pornography of an earlier age. So they were wild and zany and pornographic and...
all those things.
Humorous, yeah. And you know, a lot of the stuff went over the heads of the kids. But then they did make this great migration into the nursery. Disney then took them up, and they became cartoon-like. So we thought of them, you know, we sort of grew up thinking of them as for children. And the fact of the matter is you know, as Hollywood is telling us today, they are not. They're stories for adults as well, and adolescents, and everything.
But do you think that when you take all these stories together, and obviously each one having its own unique tale, that it is a way for children to understand what the adult world is about without telling them in that very boring and direct and overt kind of way, but through animals and through all these, you know, once upon a time experiences?
Absolutely. And, yeah, once upon a time, we're now in a safe space. Anything goes here. It's not real. And there's, you know, we're always very careful to protect our children from the hard facts of life, not just sex and violence, but death itself, you know. And here is a story, Little Red Riding Hood, that tells you about the dangers out in the world, about, you know, what happened, what if, the great what if, but in symbolic form and in a safe space. So suddenly, you know, I think the child has access through fairy tales to this world of the great existential mysteries, but again, in a way that, you know, it may have scary elements in it, but... you know, it is, it's not real, it's symbolic. And this story will help you go back and navigate reality. It won't give you, you know, completely clear solutions, but it's going to tell you that you need to have your wits about you, you need to have courage, you need to face the monster, and you will get back home again. It offers a message of hope as well.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about fairy tales, folk tales, their evolution, why they mean so much to so many people, including children and adults. And again, our guest is Maria Tatar. She's the John L. Loeb Professor of Germanic Languages and Literature. She chairs the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University, and she's written a number of books about fairy tales, folk tales. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet, at Marty Moscowane. We'll be right back.
Abington Health supports WHYY. Abington Health's Orthopedic and Spine Institute performs a procedure called anterior hip replacement, designed to help patients recover sooner. Abington Health has performed more than 1,500 anterior hip replacements. Using mini incisions and a newly designed surgical table, surgeons are able to replace the hip joint through the front, sparing muscles, enabling many patients to leave the hospital within 24 hours. To learn more, abingtonhealth.org/hip.
the HBO documentary Six by Sondheim, featuring interviews with and music by Stephen Sondheim, debuts Monday. On the next Fresh Air, David Bianculli reviews it, and we feature our 2010 interview with Sondheim. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The man of the century, the last century.
A man who took history in his hands and bent the arc of the moral universe towards justice.
From prisoner to president, Nelson Mandela and the way forward for Africa and the world. Voices of the people who knew him best on The Takeaway, next time from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Maria Tatar about why children love stories about beheadings and wicked stepmothers and cannibalism and wolves and trickery. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Amy from, looks like Downingtown, to join our conversation. Amy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Hi. My question is about the Chinese story, Ye Shen. It's a Cinderella story. My middle schoolers used to be fascinated by it, and our favorite parts were always the fact that the fairy godmother was some dead fish bones for most of the story. And at the end, the stepfamily gets killed by this falling avalanche out in the mountains. It's kind of a crazy story, and I wondered if your guests knew about it.
Well, let me find out. Do you know that story, Maria Tadar?
I do, and I included it in my anthology, Classic Fairy Tales, the first in the lineup, because it is so strange, and yet it's still a Cinderella tale. We forget how violent these stories were in their earlier versions. That is, the Grimm's Cinderella, even. It ends with doves pecking out the eyes of the stepsisters. And they go to church. The doves peck out the left eyes. They go out of church. They leave. Doves peck out the right eye. And the stepsisters also cut off their toes and heels so that their feet will fit the shoe. So there are all kinds of terrible things going on. There's an Indonesian version of Cinderella in which the girl sends her stepsister bundled up in a neat little package to her stepmother, and it's labeled salt meat. So there are these just ghoulish versions of the story. And, you know, they circulate. They're all over the world. They're not just, you know, on one continent or in one region.
Amy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And it's an interesting theme here, which is the stepmother, stepsisters. Why are they so central or play such a central role in so many of these stories?
Now, these stories are all about the family, the hyper-dysfunctional family. That's why they're so interesting.
Yes.
And they're mythical in that way, too, because, you know, look at the Greek gods. They're always fighting and doing terrible things to each other. And so, you can read this in two ways, I think. One, you know, it could represent social reality today and, you know, in earlier centuries, especially think of the high mortality rates for women in an earlier age. But today, with high divorce rates, stepmothers are part of the family. How do you work out that relationship where there may be some hostility or there may be a favoring of a biological daughter? We have lots of stories like that in the fairy tale repertoire. But as Bruno Bettelheim tells us in his wonderful Uses of Enchantment, which, you know, a book that I have differences with, but it's a book that legitimized the academic study of fairy tales. He tells us that the stepmother is really a proxy for the real mother.
Oh, interesting.
And that, you know, you can project all kinds of terrible things onto the stepmother that you would not do to, you know, your real mother. And Bettelheim tells us this has to do with the ambivalence we all feel about our mothers, and the fairy tale gives us the good mother, who is often dead, the good biological mother, And then the evil, mobile, crafty, wicked stepmother.
Well, I'm thinking of the stepmother in the juniper tree. So she beheads her son, serves him in a stew to his father, right? Did I get that right?
That is correct. Yeah, and the father says, "Boy, this tastes so good. I just can't get enough of it."
Yikes! And then she's crushed to death.
This is, as I said, mythical. You know, we're talking about the Feast of Atreus, but brought down to a domestic level. And I think one of the scariest parts is that after the stepmother beheads the boy, you know, she lures him to the trunk with an apple. So, you know, there's a biblical overtone to
absolutely.
All of this as well. But then she puts the head back on, and his little sister comes along and knocks him over by accident and thinks that she's beheaded him.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and then, you know, it becomes a story of revenge. The boy comes back as a bird and drops a millstone. You know, again, it has a biblical weight to it. He drops a millstone on her head. And I think, you know, the most disturbing part for me is that the father, the boy, and the girl live happily ever after without a mother. That the, you know, as in Hansel and Gretel, the happily ever after comes when the mother has been erased,
right.
Has disappeared. So this sends me a signal about how important it is, as Jamie said, to keep the stories relevant. And maybe I would put it to make them our own. That is, we don't have to accept just because Charles Perrault wrote the story down in the 18th century or the Brothers Grimm wrote down a tale in the 19th doesn't mean that it's written in granite. We can take the story, we can begin to improvise, we can take it back to the oral tradition, we can make a film of it, we can turn it into an advertisement. But do something to make it our story rather than a story from long ago and far away.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. We have, looks like, Carmela from Roxborough joining us on Radio Times. Carmela, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I worked in a summer program with children, had to develop a storytelling program, and the word stranger, I took that word stranger because I thought, well, that's a great word. Looked it up, discovered it's a derivative from a German word, which means he who comes from the woods.
Wow.
And I just thought the connotations of that were absolutely amazing. And it just seems to me that it was the basis for so many fairy tales.
Well, that's fascinating, Carmela. Let me see what our guest has to say about that. What do you think, Maria?
Oh, well, thanks for that comment, because last summer I spent time with children ages 5 to 12 at a Take Your Kids to Work Day at Harvard, and I read different versions of Little Red Riding Hood to this group, and then I asked them, you know, what is the story about? What does it mean? And I got a chorus of stranger danger. It was extraordinary. They all, you know, so that was the first thing that came into their heads. Mm-hmm. And this is a story, you know, if you inflect it for today, it is a story about those predators, the mm-hmm. urban predators that you do have to worry about. And it signals to the child, you know, what do you do? How do you outwit? How do you outfox? You should actually have a story about turns tale into a modern version for us.
Carmela, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Marlene from Medford, New Jersey has to say. And Marlene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Do we have Marlene? No.
The late 70s, I heard Bruno Bettelheim. And then and immediately after, I heard your guest, the professor, mention him.
Yes.
And his book, The Uses of Enchantment, which I think won in 77 or something. And he talked about how his housekeeper, or I guess she was sort of his nursemaid when he was growing up, would tell him these stories and frighten him so. But he had a Freudian analysis of most of them, of the fairy tales, and felt they were so helpful because they liberated his emotions of fear and could project them and learn to deal with them. And it educated him, and he felt educated other children, too.
Sure.
This you know, abandonment and death and witches and injuries and... well, anyway, he was fascinating, and I was so, it is now, how many years later? 40 at least, and I still remember him vividly.
Well,
It was a conference in Philadelphia, a psychological conference that I was just acting as an usher.
Well, but you got to hear
him.
No, I think that's great, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Marlene. And Maria, we could do a whole hour about Bruno Bettelheim and where you perhaps agree or disagree. But I think what I hear from Marlene, and I think Bruno Bettelheim as well, is that the children love these stories because it helps them navigate and understand the world that we live in.
That's right. Yeah, it gives them access to all kinds of scary things, and it is cathartic. You know, the story becomes cathartic. I think Bettelheim was a little too confident about the therapeutic power of the tale. And one point of disagreement for me is he sort of felt that the child should be on his or her own with the story. And I'm all for conversational readings. I think the great thing about these stories is that they fascinate children, but they are also really powerful for adults. So we love to sit and read these stories with children or watch them.
Marlene.
And then talk about them. Talk about, you know, what is scary? What can I learn from this tale? And not, you know, the moral of don't stray from the path, which is usually put in our picture books about little, because I kind of think children should stray from paths and explore and be curious. So, yeah.
Yeah, Marlene, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I am a huge fan, as I think millions of people are, of the work of Maurice Sendak, and as far as I'm concerned, Where the Wild Things Are is just about a perfect book on so many different levels. But do you see him as the sort of contemporary creator of fairy tales for children?
Oh, absolutely. And remember that he illustrated the Brothers Grimm.
That's right.
He was a huge fan of that collection and of things German in general. He loved the work of Heinrich von Kleist, of all people. And so I think he did create a new kind of folklore, because Mickey and Max, yep, are now, you know, they've migrated out of their stories and become part of our collective consciousness, cultural consciousness. So I would say that Where the Wild Things Are started out as a literary text, as something written down, but has now become folkloric. That is, we, mm-hmm, you know, you say wild things and you immediately imagine those creatures.
Sure.
And again, you know, there's now so many different versions. We have films about them. They appear in ads. You know, I walked into one of our houses at Harvard, the dorms, and there's a whole tunnel that has the wild things painted on them.
Oh, how cool is that? And those wild things say to Max, you know, we'll eat you up, we love you so, right?
Oh, yeah, right. It's Little Red Riding Hood. It
exactly.
Really is a version of Little Red Riding Hood. The monsters out on that island.
Let me see what looks like Tracy from Glen Mills has to say. Tracy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
So I heard this conversation and wanted to call in. I grew up in a small German community, which was, you know, we had no TV and read all the original Brothers Grimm in all their full glory details. And as a small child, I remember my sister deciding she was going to make up her own stories. And it was kind of an example of how the folklore aspect of it started, because she would tell these stories and in them, you know, the little kids would get eaten up by the witch or whatever. And the rest of us kids would all cry and tell her, no, no, you can't do that. And so the next night the story would be different. And then this time she'd try some new ending. And then, no, no, that was not good enough. And so eventually we settled on one story where, you know, she ended up not making her siblings sob to sleep. And it involved the kids cooking the witch, and after the witch tried to attack their pet green horse.
Oh, excellent
story. But And
we know what Tracy.
I have to every night after that.
Well,
a night story.
And I'm sorry to do this only because we're just about out of time here. But Maria, I mean, to me, that's just a great way of the sort of group read and
yeah.
how you can come to a conclusion that everyone's happy with.
It's the folkloric imagination at work. It's just a great, great story. Thank you for that.
Yeah, Tracy, thanks very much. And only about a minute or so before I have to say goodbye, but your enduring interest in fairy tales, Maria Tatar, where did that come from briefly?
Oh, I think it goes back to when I was a child and I had a book of fairy tales, and it was in German. I could not read it. But I did look at the pictures, and my older sister told me the stories. She was, you know, she knew something. She didn't know German, but she had heard the stories, and I think probably made them up to some extent, just like the sister
like,
of your caller.
Like
and so, you know, there, you know, it was the stories, the old stories, made relevant, and the mysteries came through with those extraordinary images.
Well, Maria Tatar, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times to talk about fairy tales.
Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. And she teaches at Harvard University. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out with a 1966 hit, Little Red Riding Hood by Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. Let's listen.
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood. Think little big girl should go walking in these spooky old woods alone. Oh! What big eyes you have, the kind of eyes that drive wolves mad. So just to see that you don't get chased, I think I ought to walk with you far away. Sheet suit on.